Hey everyone, welcome back to the Most of a Podcast, where we talk things, culture, identity, and everything in between. Today's episode is a little different in the best way possible, okay? I sat down with my dear friend, Dr. Okoro. Now, fair warning, this episode gets a bit rowdy. Having just finished editing it, I'm able to reflect on the fact that, it gets a bit rowdy. So we argued, we teased each other a lot. And yes, he called me by my first name, the version I reserve for people who've earned the right to use it as a timestamp of our closeness. That's how you know it's real. I left in all the good banter because that's what you get when two friends, both passionate, both stubborn, talk about life, legacy, and a whole lot more. So buckle up for a fun, fiery, and full of heart conversation. And happy Father's Day. Let's get into it. Now enjoy the show. Welcome back everyone to the podcast. Today I'm joined by someone who's been in my life, I'll say, for over 15 years now. We first met as NYC coppers in the timeless chaotic city of Ibadan. Ibadan is one of the southwestern states we have in Nigeria. It's a city in one of the southwestern states in Nigeria. He's a very proud Igbo physician and I'm proudly Yoruba, so assume all you can assume about that. During my time in Ibadan, it was very refreshing to find someone that we shared some taste in music. We had very intelligent conversations and we both loved Emma at the same time. We also bonded over Family Guy. It's the kind of satire and the kind of debates I think could stretch from ducks to dawn. But don't be fooled by his white coat. Ike, as I call him, he's no ordinary physician or pediatrician. He's also a self-proclaimed human rights activist. He calls himself a common sense advocate, emphasis on the common, and someone whose opinions are so strong, you either laugh, gasp, or just block him, sometimes all three at once. In this special Father's Day episode, I want to just explore just his life, what has shaped him, and some questions I've been dying to ask him on camera. So welcome, Dr. Ike Chukwukuru, to the podcast. Hi, Ike.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. I didn't know I was all of those, but okay.
But you don't have any scraps. That very scratchy surface about you.
Well, if you say so. Surprisingly, I was watching Family Guy today. I watched a few episodes. They were
25 releases. It's so timeless. It's so timeless. All right. Let's ease in with some truth serum. So you've known me now for years, but we met, like I said, 15 years ago. Be very honest. What was your very first impression of me?
Believe it or not, usually I get into conversations with people and I tell them, you come into a lot of conversations I have with people and I tell them, excuse me, there are certain standards that I cannot just accept. That's the truth. No, that's just me being honest with you. And whenever I talk about you, in fact, I should think that I have mentioned you 3-4-5 times this year. And I usually tell people, when people say certain things to me, I'm like, I can't relate. Maybe I'm fortunate. Maybe I was privileged all my life to meet a certain kind of people. And then I talk about people that I have met that I consider extremely intelligent, you being one of them. And I tell people, when I was in Ibadan, I had the privilege of running into you. We had quite some conversation. In fact, the reason why we met through a mutual friend who told me, she described you as, oh, you're going to meet my friend, you're going to like her, she is really, really smart. Now, I got curious, I wanted to meet you, and you didn't disappoint. That's the truth. So, yeah, that was the reason why I wanted to meet you, because I just wanted to prove her wrong. Maybe you just call her smart so that you... what she turned out to be. One of the smartest people I've met. And this is not because I'm on your show.
I don't think I should. I know you say that, but I don't know if I should flatter or just. Fly over and come and give you a knock on the head. But yeah, shout out to that mutual friend of ours for that introduction. It was a very pleasant time in Ibadan. I was already bemoaning my movement to Ibadan, coming from Lagos, not even minding that my mother is from there. But I was like, what's it going to look like? But meeting you, and I mean, that was probably one of my highlights. I went there recently. I think I told you, right? I think we spoke.
Yeah, I saw the videos.
We went there together sometime
from Lagos.
Yeah,
we don't want to talk about that on the show. We don't want to talk about that on the show, but moving on.
Oh, wow. Well, but, you know, going back to Ibadan was almost like opening a time capsule. I tried to reroute all the paths that we took, you know, UCH, you know, PEPFA. It was just never the same. And I was like, okay, this was a time. And, of course, things have changed, but they still remain the same. And not a very pleasant way of putting it, because so many of the structures, they were run down and, you know, not properly maintained. But the memories are always still evergreen. So, yeah, thanks for being that critical part of my life. All right, so enough about that. Let's start from the beginning. To understand the man, we need to start with the boy. Can you describe what your childhood was like?
Oh, well. This feels like a therapy session. But the truth is, I come from a family of 5 children. I was the 4th, 4 boys and a girl. For most part of my life, my dad lived outside the country. He visited once a year, and we visited from time to time. But, you know, like, this family structure is not exactly the same when everyone is not around, okay? But growing up, we understood that that was a sacrifice he had to make for the betterment of everyone. Now, being in the position I was, being the 4th child, and also being the 3rd boy out of 4 boys, I had this impression, I always felt that I was the one that can be done without in my house, because, you know, when you're naughty, my mom will tell me stuff like, you know, I have 3 other sons, like, I'm not counting on you. So it sort of registered in my head that, you know, like, nobody's giving me any handouts. I'm not, like, needed, per se. So I had to work hard for everything. I had to, like, try to stand out. I had to show myself. I had to be the good boy, because if ever, like, she would tease me, if it was during the time of the slave trade, she would have sold me. Yeah. And, you know, they said a lot of stuff like that to me, that as a kid, I believed them.
You're adopted, so, maybe.
Yeah, well, no, I look exactly like my dad, so...
Okay, so there's no denying that.
Yeah,
because siblings can still always tell you you're adopted, even though you look like a spitting image of any of your parents.
True that.
Yeah.
So I had to, like, always go the extra mile to be accepted, so to speak. So that was majority of my childhood.
Yeah.
And then the older I grew, the more I realized I was a lot like my dad. And we sort of bonded in our own weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I lost him last year.
I remember.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a bit. But as we're talking about your, I'm sorry for your loss once again. You know, my condolences.
Thank you about that.
Yeah, we will talk about that in a bit. But as we're talking about just, you know, how you grew up and just your search for identity and having to be perfect in a way not to cause any troubles, but to feel like you belong. Have you let go of that cloak of, you know, wanting to be accepted? Is this not something you still carry around you?
Maybe that actually had, like, let's say the opposite feel.
Yeah.
You know, like, when you have done something, you know, like, when you grew up poor and then suddenly you have, like, new money, you want to, like, believe everything you feel you've missed, and you want to, you know, you can, So when you grow up trying hard to be accepted every time, when you grow up, eventually, you would realize that you don't really care about that anymore. That's why I'm very vocal. Like, I really don't care about people's opinion per se about me, if it's going to be something to say. Like, I've seen that all my life. So a whole lot of who I am today comes from the fact that I have been this person all my life. And at this point, I really don't care. I can say anything I want, and I really, really don't care. That's why people perceive me as a very vocal person.
Okay. All right. You have, you know, moved around quite a bit. I know the last time I kept track of you, because I always do this yearly call where we just catch up wherever we stopped, right? you've done Ibadan, and then you went back to the East, and you're sometime in Oman, and then I think Saudi Arabia, and then back in the UK, right? So maybe talk a little bit about your educational pathway. What inspired you to study medicine?
My dad, again.
So he was a physician, right?
Yeah, and I tell people that I don't have a medical bone in my body. I don't have a scientific bone in my body. I have always been an art student. I don't know if you know this. Maybe but you know, I draw professionally. Like, I actually draw people and do paintings and stuff like that. Yeah. So I do that, and I do a lot of write-offs. Like, everything about me is art. Like, I'm more of an art person. But my dad wasn't having it, because having left Nigeria and being in the Western world and seeing, he saw things that we didn't see. Like, we thought, having been exposed newly to democracy just about the time that I was leaving secondary school, okay, we thought that democracy was going to bring some form of economic boom for the country. Yeah, yeah. So nobody was planning to leave, like, this whole Jaffa thing but he saw that, and you know, like, he could tell what's going on right now doesn't give a good prognostic whatever for the future, okay? Yeah. And he felt you would be better positioned in life to be, if you were a doctor, okay, just in case Nigeria doesn't work out. Yeah. Now, I didn't see the sense in that. I thought, you know, it's my dad trying to have his way again. But in retrospect, I think I see what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So he said, medicine doesn't stop you from doing whatever it is you want to do. You want to be an artist, you want to be a musician, you want to go into theater, production, entertainment, whatever it is you want to do. Do businesses, some of which I'm doing right now. Go ahead, do whatever you want to do, but have something to fall back on.
Mm.
And I'm glad I took that advice. And yeah, so I,
because you have been very, very broke as an artist. Let's be very real. I mean, even though you're very talented, your people skills are very lacking. So thank heavens you listened to your dad.
Like, part of being an artist is also acting. You can act it even if you don't feel it. Half the times in business, you just have to, like, fake a smile for everyone. Yeah. That's really how you feel.
What a wise man. And I imagine what he experienced also through, you know, Biafra War and, you know, just your tribe as a whole, that was more of a jarring reality for him. Like, oh no, I got to set my kids up, you know, just in case anything happens in the future, right?
Yes. Yeah, again, like I said, my dad was one hardworking man, very hardworking, extremely hardworking. And it was one of the things that, you know, that I admire about him. My dad came from, like, the poorest family you could imagine. Mm. Like, in fact, you can't imagine. My dad grew up in a mud house. You know, like how you see the English textbooks of the old, where you see the mud thatched house. So, like, he lost his dad at a young age.
Wow.
The mom could barely take care of them. And he had to be shipped off to Lagos to be what we call a houseboy in Nigeria at a very young age. And he wasn't even going to school at the time. So the person he was staying with, the kids, go to school. So when they go to school and come back, he takes their textbooks and he taught himself how to read and write. So
that's how he did it.
That's how he did. Now I'm going to bust your brain on this, but this is an unbelievable story. But my dad didn't go to secondary school. No.
Go ahead. I'm shocked,
dad,
right?
My dad has never seen the four walls of a secondary school ever in his life. So he did this, and then when he learned how to read and write, he went for a typing.
Yeah, correspondence course.
Yeah, and then he was one of those people on Allen Avenue with their old typewriters, chasing after bankers and trying to type documents for them. And then he was trying to take care of his siblings and all that, and sort out his mom and everybody in the village. So at some point, I don't know, but I think something pushed him, something nudged him. He was already in his late adolescent age. And I think somebody, he said something, according to him, somebody he was also paying school fees for, who was also very close to his age. And he was like, let there at least be one educated person in the family. Okay, I'm out here busting my ass trying to get you through school and you're not doing it. And then the person's words were, well, you could have done it yourself if it was that easy to get. I mean, you smartly dodged it and then you're now making it
expecting
look like,
me, yeah.
Yes, it's easy. And my dad was like, I'm sacrificing my life trying to get you through school. And this you're thinking I'm doing it because... So at that point in time, that was when you realized that, well, it's never too late to start something. And that was when the first time my dad just decided, what do I do? Start A-level courses. And then he just started because he couldn't really read and write. He had no secondary education. If my dad should run for Nigerian president, they would ask me for his but he had A levels, so he started, and that was where he started.
A levels, you know how hard that is.
Yeah, he took classes. Like he said,
even people with WAEC and SSC that went through the four walls of a secondary school still struggle with A levels.
Yeah, and he kept on with that, and from there, that's when he left for the UK, and from there, that's how he started. And you know, like, something you did out of because you were passionate and because you were pushed. He didn't go to school like us. That's, you know, sometimes you think you're doing your parents a favor by going to school.
Yeah,
he was doing it because he was chasing after something. And so in my house, you see, the dynamics were quite different because he had no excuse. We had everything. Like he sacrificed everything to make sure you were comfortable. So you can't just come home and say, oh, I'm not doing well in school, because I mean, he did it while under the toughest circumstances ever.
Wow, the pressure.
So he had no reason. Yeah, so he had no reason, so he had the pressure.
Wow. And he studied medicine in the UK?
Yes.
Are you kidding me? Who was this man, IK? Wow. You know, one of your fun questions and memories that you share with me is just how much the relationship between your mom and your dad.
Yes. Now, my mom, again, is a woman that I would say has done something that a lot of women didn't do, because during this time that I was talking about, I mean, the family background that my dad had, he didn't come from a wealthy home, okay? So he had basically no support. Now, when he left the country, that was when he was in Nigeria for a bit. He traveled, came back. And then when he was leaving the last time, we were babies. In fact, I don't think I was even born at the time. The first time he left before he came back and then left again. Now, he had married my mom at the time, and my mom was working. My dad had a job in University of Nigeria then. I can't remember what he was working as, but he was working in University of Nigeria then. It is very early age. I think in those days, you could just get a job. Like, it was easy to get a job, a government job. So he worked there for some time. My mom was working in the ministry. My mom had a master's degree, and she graduated from university, and she married him. So when my dad was about to leave the country at the time, they weren't going to let him go they weren't going to let us stay in the university quarters, because if my dad leaves, we would have to give up the house. We didn't have any other house anywhere. We couldn't afford anyone at the time. So my mom had to resign her job from where she was working.
She was,
in those days, like someone that was my mom's age that had a master's degree as far back as 1982 or so.
Wow.
So she had to leave her job in the ministry, took a job as a teacher, which was what the fastest thing she could get in one of the staff schools in the University of Nigeria, so that we could just
skip the first job she could
take. That they would take her as a senior staff. So we kept the house, and during that time, my mom was doing all manners of business at the same time.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. We had a poultry, we had a bakery, we had a small grocery store, we had a restaurant, and my mom was doing.
She was doing all of that
at the same time.
I'm thinking of kids.
And then she had four toddlers at the same time.
Oy.
So she wakes up in the morning, she's trying to get us ready for school, and then you run around and you pour yourself palm oil, and then she has to change, and then she does all that. Then she runs to the restaurant and she's sure everything is ready. She does the accounts in the grocery store. She runs off, takes us to school, then goes for her own job, comes back in the evening, and then she sorts out the restaurant people, makes sure that the chicken... Well, we had people. We had a lot of help at the time, though. Make sure the chickens are alive and the birds are okay. And then she makes sure we do our homework. We get our siesta. We've had our shower. We go to bed. And then in the night, in the parlor, you're hearing the sewing machine going the whole night. And then she's trying to... And then sometimes I hear her take phone calls. Then it was the landline.
Yeah.
People will call, of course, Nigerian tailor. She was a Nigerian tailor. So people will call and be sure to have my clothes ready by tomorrow. And then she'll be making promises. I'll try my best. And then she does this the whole night. She wakes up in the morning. She does this again. Now, at the end of the day, when she makes all this, whatever change she makes, she brings out our school fees. She brings out whatever it is. And then she finds a way of sending the rest to my dad, who was going to school.
Wow.
Okay. At the time, because he needed all the support he had.
Wow.
So she kept on sending it. So my mom was also very instrumental in my dad's
life.
So she would hustle here, do 5 jobs at a time, send the money there. So you see, there's a level of respect that my dad has for my mom that if you look around these days, I don't think this can ever happen again. I don't see it happening.
It's very rare.
But she did it. Yeah.
It's very rare. It's one thing for your husband to leave the country and then go hustle. Usually the hustle is what they send back home to help. But for the woman to like stay behind with those 4 kids,
in Nigeria,
have all the 5 jobs, and then be sending money to the husband.
But you know, like, you know, then
it was then, good old days, right? Yeah, Naira, the appreciation.
Naira had some value, exactly. Yeah, so it was almost at par.
So
if you sent it back, it made some. Yeah, so.
Oh, okay. Wow, what a life. And kudos to your mom and their story as a whole. If you guys haven't done it, I think you should definitely write a book about your parents and just their life. And
Yeah.
I mean, I know he's no longer here, but just even being able to keep that legacy alive. There was something I read somewhere, like 3 generations from now, we might end up being forgotten, right? If you think about it, even when you're great, we'll be forgotten, right? We're hoping that with podcasts being evergreen, our voices and, you know, our works might still be preserved. But 3 generations from now, your great grandkids might never remember who you are, what you look like. They might hear faintly about you, but not all the time. But yeah, thanks for sharing that. So you went to UNN, right? You studied medicine there.
Yeah, I studied medicine in Ebonyi State University.
No, it wasn't Ebonyi State University, no. Were you in Ebonyi State University?
Yes, I lived in UNN. So, like, all my life was in UNN. Everything I did in my life was in UNN. But I actually studied medicine in Ebonyi State University. It felt like a lot of people think I was in UNN because all my story, everything. It's a 30-minute drive from
Nsukka.
Enugu to Ebonyi State. Yeah. So for most part I was, and you know, living at home I could drive, come back.
Yeah.
So this, most of my story sounds UNN, but it was in UNN.
Because you guys lived in the quarters. Wow. I didn't know that. Okay. So you live in the UK now, right? Living in Nigeria changes a person, right? What parts of you would you say have stayed the same, or what has radically shifted since moving abroad?
Okay. Empathy, sympathy.
You don't have it anymore? Because you didn't have a lot before, okay.
I think I have more of it right now.
Whoa!
Because I've always been an empathic person.
Empathy is what you have?
Yeah, I just don't, you know, like, I don't like making excuses. But, I mean, when you have to show some sympathy, some empathy, you have to. Now, sometimes, getting older, I ask myself, I could have been any other person, any other person could have been any other person.
Mm.
A good part of why we are who we are is because of the things around us. It's a whole lot of nurture. It's not exactly like, I have this theory that I tell people, usually when I hear people say, if I were you, I would have done this. If I wear your shoes, I would have done this. And I'm like, well, you're not in the person's shoes. In fact, the theory is, every single person will do the exact same thing if they are in the exact same conditions.
Yeah.
So if you were exactly in my condition, then you're going to be exactly in my condition. You're going to be me. You're going to be my complexion. You're going to be my height. You will have my name. You would have experienced everything I have gone through in life, the joys, the trauma, everything. Your thought process, your formation, everything will be
choices.
Me.
So yeah.
At that point in time, you're going to do the exact same thing that I have. You're going to have the same dose of adrenaline in you. Biologically, you're going to be me. So you're going to do exactly what I did. So you can't say if you were me. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Now, I am me. Some other person is them. You don't know why. What I have done some things and I have experienced some tough times in my life. And there was a time in my life I thought I was invincible. I thought there were certain things that couldn't happen to me. But I realized that it's not about what you know. It's not about what you're capable of. It's not about what you can do. Life happens. There is the God factor which you cannot just sweep under the rug.
Yeah.
You get, sometimes it's not just what's supposed to happen. Sometimes you don't understand why such things happen. My dad was hale and hearty. He just came back to Nigeria and went to the village and just died. No reason. You get. So things just happen like that. Now, I'm starting to look at people and I understand that I see myself in those people. Like, I wonder, I see someone who sits around and there was a day I told someone, you know, like, a little story. I asked someone, I said, if you were asked to, a friend of mine was telling me something and we were much younger, a bit younger, not much younger, but a few years ago. I said, if you were going to, if they told you to go to prison for 10 years,
okay,
and then after 10 years, you'll be paid 10 billion naira, would you go to prison for 10 years? And he was like, why not? He would go to prison for 10 billion naira for 10 years. He's in Nigeria. And he's like, you know what that means? That comes to over 80 million naira for the rest of my life a month. If I take 80 million naira, I'm going to be having about 960 million every year. In the next 10 years, like, I'm going to have close to a billion every year.
Wow.
I was like, this is not difficult. And he said, how? I was like, okay, imagine you're going to go to prison for 10 years. Now, this is IK talking, okay? Mm-hmm. I said, imagine if you're going to go to prison for 10 years. Pick up your books, disappear for 10 years. Go and write, you've been complaining. The last time I saw you 10 years ago, you were complaining, Nigeria no good, Nigeria no good. 10 years later, Nigeria no good, Nigeria no good. And from the look of things, you're going to be complaining for the next 10 years. So why don't you just pick up, write, jump? If you write, jump, you're an adult. Try to get into a medical school, a cheap medical school in your state. Go from home. Don't go to school the way we went to school. Go to school because now you're focused and you know what you want to do. Sit down, read for 6 years. First 6 years, just read your ass out. Graduate as a medical doctor. You should be more than 30 on graduation, so you're just going to do your internship. No year service. That would be year seven. And that same year seven, as you're doing your internship, be preparing for your USMLE. Now, if you studied hard and study like you're in prison because you're not going to do any other thing, do your USMLE, and then you get matched by your year eight. It's going to be your first year of residency training. Year nine will be your second year. Year 10 will be your third year. You will be done with residency training in the US. That's 10 years. The least you're going to be earning is about 300,000 to 350,000 a year.
So that's 10 billion.
That's not 10 billion, but if you do 350,000 to 400,000, you're going to be earning about roughly about $35,000 a month. Now, if you turn that to Naira, 35,000 is about 70 million. Now, you've not done a fellowship, you've not done other things. And mind you, from the time you started your residency training in the US, you're earning a little money.
Yeah.
It's not like, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I finished it. And like I told you, this is IK talking. There's a whole lot of senselessness in what I said now, but someone that is an advocate of common sense, you get. If you actually like break down what I said down, but that's me talking like everybody should do something. I used to blame people for not doing stuff, you get. But now, when we finished, the person looked at me and said, you just imagine that people can just do this, right? Yeah. Like, have you ever realized that everybody's assimilation when they read, let's start with the jam, that the fact that you think that somebody can just pick up a book
and then read,
only for jump in 3 months and get 600, it's not because they are not serious. They can actually spend longer hours than you do reading, and they still will not be able to figure out this thing. These people have to go and study physics, chemistry, biology, and then read it to this point and understand everything. Everybody's mind does not work the same.
The same way, exactly.
And it's not the same for everybody. Don't just think that because certain things are not happening for people, it's because they have not worked hard enough. All right. Now, like I told you, all my life, all we knew was work hard.
Because daddy did it.
My daddy did it. We came from a family. And I personally, my position in the family and from the kind of things I had work hard. So I used to think that was... But now I just realized that people have other problems. There are so many other things, psychological, even psychiatric, behavioral. Some people have issues that we neglect just because they try to put up a front and try to blend with the society. We think everything is fine with everybody and we don't put those things into consideration. Now, having left the country and going back to Nigeria and seeing things, I understand that a whole lot of things are just happening. It's just the way God wanted. It is more of a blessing than actually what we did or what we didn't do. As a matter of fact, we didn't do anything. We are just on a path and we just did what other people sweat can pave the way for us to do. And we just did it.
Wow, thanks for sharing that. And so sympathy has increased since you left the country. That's good to see. So definitely living abroad has changed you. Maybe that's the westernization your dad was hoping to bring back home, but you found it when you crossed to the other side of the pond. So you are a pediatrician, right?
I did my training in pediatrics. I left it around Saudi Arabia.
Oh, so what are you doing? Just a general practitioner?
Now I work. I do mostly emergency room duties in Saudi Arabia. I was at the emergency room doctor, and I worked in the ICU.
Yeah.
And here I work in the emergency room as well.
Do you like it?
No.
But it pays the bills, baby.
Yeah, the much you can. Yeah.
Do you miss pediatrics or?
No.
Okay. Do you enjoy medicine? I know you said that wasn't your path.
No.
Like you just did it. Okay. I could tell. Just that's it.
No. Well, I became a pediatrician because there's this exam you have to write when you graduate. It's called the primaries. I have three primaries. Yeah. So I wrote the first primaries in family medicine. If you remember, at the time I was in Ibadan, I was in family medicine department. Yeah. So because I was in family medicine, I was like, okay, this is my first exposure to postgraduate anything, so do prep. I did that. I went for every interview, like in more than 8-9 teaching hospitals. At the time, family medicine wasn't like very popular like that, so they were very limited teaching hospitals that offered residency training in family medicine. And I wasn't getting a residency training, so I had to write another one in community medicine, which, from what they said at the time, we thought was easy. Now, we know that it's not easy, but we thought it was, you know, the clinical aspect was, so I did community medicine. And then I started my interview hunt again in community medicine and started flying around everywhere. And when that wasn't forthcoming, then I was doing one locum job in Port Harcourt in one pediatric hospital that nobody wanted to work in because it was really busy. But because I needed a job, I just took it. And while I was there, I just realized, well, kids are cute. And my boss was nice. So when he asked me, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I'm like, probably do residency training somewhere. And he was like, where? I was like, I don't know. He was like, so why don't you do pediatrics? I was like, yeah, okay. And now, because nobody liked pediatrics, people usually run away from pediatrics because of the complexity. So I felt maybe I may stand a chance. And true, I also did my third primaries in pediatrics. And the first interview I went for, in fact, the first two interviews I went for, I got the two places. I had to pick one. I had to drop one and take the other one. So, yeah, that's how I started pediatrics. So it wasn't driven by passion or driven by the love for pediatrics.
No, it was just
inspiration to get a job.
Okay. Would you go back to it?
No.
Probably not. Okay.
Right. Well, if I get that dispute again, of course, I'll go back to anything, but
yeah,
I would really walk into it still.
Okay. So you've moved around a lot. How did you end up practicing medicine in the UK?
Okay, well, this is a trick question because I'm going to sidestep some information intentionally.
Sure. Yeah.
So at some point while I was in Nigeria, it wasn't working. Truth is that at that time, a resident doctor in Nigeria earns somewhere between 250,000 to 450,000. That's at the maximum. So on the average, about 350,000 naira, which is about 200.
It's not a lot. Like, it's about, yeah, it's not a lot. It's not a lot. It's about 200. Yeah, about, let's say $300 if you are being very magnanimous with the exchange rate. Yeah,
no.
Per month. Okay, yeah, $230. $230.
Yeah, thereabouts per month.
Yeah.
Now, everybody is screaming at you, go get married, you're supposed to do this. You've got it to the point where you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do this, and you're like, come on. Now, Ituko Azala was not in Enugu. It was in Ituko Azala. It's a good 20-something, 30 kilometers away from town. Now, to drive that route, every morning and come back, I used to, at the time fuel was, whatever the price fuel was then, I used to spend about 40, 50,000 naira fuel.
Wow. For how long?
A month. That was my fuel. So if your salary is 300,000 naira, 50,000 naira goes on fuel in a month.
How about the car maintenance? And then car maintenance, you know?
The maintenance, your personal, your bills, your rent, and a whole lot of things. So it wasn't working. And I just looked and I saw, this is not working. Okay. And what's the future to this? You finish, you start practicing as a consultant in Nigeria. For how much? Okay. Now, what am I chasing at this point in time? Am I chasing the title or am I chasing survival? Everybody in Nigeria is in survival mode right now. And I was like, I have to survive first before I start attaching titles. Okay. So at that point in time, that was when Saudi was taking a lot of Nigerian doctors around the time. So I got this and then I moved to Saudi. Now, Saudi was a tough place to work in because all the Arabic I knew was Assalamu Alaikum, and, you know, they just threw into work. Surprisingly, I realized that nobody in Saudi speaks English. At least it's part of Saudi I was in. Nobody speaks English, like the regular citizens.
So how do you treat patients?
Yeah, so sometimes if I manage to charm my way into getting one of the nurses that speak both, they will do the interpretation for me. So initially, I wasn't seeing patients. I was doing, I was mostly on ambulance services. So when they want to move a patient, the critical patient from one point to the other point, now this is a patient that is intubated or something. So I'm like this. I was just running around in the ambulance. I had to start learning Arabic. I'm not Tolani, you know, you have a pain for languages and it comes easy for you. Okay, so I spent all those years in Ibadan and it didn't pass. like, it was just the very basics. It was just the very basics that I was able to learn. Okay, so I just learned medical Arabic just enough to get by with patients. And when I was comfortable enough to see patients, I started seeing patients. But, you know, like Saudi, the cultural difference was just very vast. So there are just a whole lot of things that, you know, if you're not from there, you're not from there. It's not just...
How long were you there for?
Just over 4 years.
Well, that's a long time.
Yeah, so at that point in time, I had to just start looking to move. Yeah. At least somewhere I could interact with patients.
Yeah.
You know, if you come back from a tough day at work, you could pour a glass of wine for yourself and then relax.
You could drink wine?
Yeah, here now in the UK, in Saudi, no.
I mean Saudi, yeah. There was nothing to drink, so it was just water and pomegranate juice.
Yeah, that's just that. Nothing more. You know, wow. Like, not that I'm heavy on drinking, but you know.
But still, you need an outlet. Yeah, you cannot drink. All of a sudden, it's what you
want to
do.
The fact that you're told that you can't do this just makes you want to do it even more. You get so. It's not like you're going to do it anyway, but.
But still, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The infusions were just too many.
Yeah.
They were nicer. It was surprisingly, I was more impressed than I thought I was going to be. I was really scared when I was going to Saudi. You know, like the media doesn't, you know, reflect the complete truth.
Because
when I was moving to Saudi, I was reading a lot of things about Saudi and I was really, really scared. Surprisingly, they were one of the nicest people that I have ever met in my life. This, the first time I had that kind of shock was when I came to Ibadan. You know, like down in the east, the Easterners feel, you know, they have been wronged by the Yorubas.
Yeah.
I don't know why the Yorubas, what their own is, but I know that this is what the Easterners feel. But I know that there is this tribal tension between the two tribes, okay?
Yeah.
So when I was coming to the West, I was like, okay, my uncle was state coordinator at the time in Ibadan, so I was a bit comfortable. But I didn't, I just had these trust issues. Now, getting to Ibadan, I just realized that I learned so much that my consultant, when I was doing pediatrics, whenever he sees me, he would just bow. Like, he bows to me because he thought it was ridiculous that I do it, because I prostrate when I greet people. Like, when I came back to the East, like, if I want to give my consultant, I prostrate. And to him, he thought he was like, why do you keep doing that? So when he sees me, he just does that, like...
Yeah.
This guy that is always, but it had entered my body to get. I just knew this is how to greet and
show respect.
How to show respect. People were nice, very humbly, and it wasn't so much as what you call it, in a way you don't want people around.
You
don't want your culture tainted somehow, like you're not sure what this person is going to do if you bring them in. Not that you have a problem with this person, but we have a lifestyle that we wouldn't want you to, you know. But if they say you're cool and this person is respectful and he knows his boundaries and he knows that you're not going to come and disrespect everything that we have built in all our lives, and you just come and, because you're not from around here, people become a little bit skeptical having you around. But I just saw that it was not nearly. If you don't, if you're not in support of NYSC, which a lot of Nigerians aren't, I would say,
I think
you should do NYSC. Yes.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might change your view to things. I met you. I met a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
One day I messed up, though, but, you know, I'll meet
just
your
one
friend.
Day? Just one day?
Yeah, just one day. I met our mutual friend's mom. And then, being an Igbo person, you know, like, it's culturally accepted to call someone her age, auntie. So I said, auntie, good afternoon. And I looked at her and she turned red, like she was fuming. I didn't know what I did. The woman, you know, being older and being in the position that she understood that, this person is not from around here. And I meant no disrespect.
Yeah.
But when
she
left, this lady talked to me. I was like, you called my mom, auntie. I was like, yes. Like, what was I supposed to call her? Like, you called. And then she was really upset. So I learned.
I have a lot of evil friends. I grew up with a lot of evils and I'm used to that, and it just tickles me a little bit. I don't count that as respectful. But yeah, I can imagine, just in her case where she, you know, exposure and all that, probably that's why she reacted that way. But okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for sharing all of that. What kind of medicine did your dad practice, by the way?
My dad was a lab.
A what?
In the lab.
Oh, lab. Pathology? Pathology?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Nice. Okay. So let's segue a little bit to the section people either came for or came to cancel, you know. And you and I have gone head to head on some of this related topic. You're often labeled, fairly or not, as chauvinistic when it comes to women's issues. I think I've called you that many times, right? IK, why do you hate women so much?
I'm afraid of viewers at this point in time will be like, this guy, chauvinistic, he doesn't sound it, he doesn't look it.
I have received.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to do what people do online and say, define chauvinism. What exactly does it mean to be chauvinistic? What is chauvinism here?
I guess your views about women. What do you think people? Let me turn it back to you. Why do you think? What do you think people misunderstand about you when it comes to women?
Because I hold everybody accountable equally. I would say I'm one of the very few true feminists that exists in the world today. And if you go by exactly what feminism should be, we should be equal opportunities, equal choices, justice, and fairness, equity, accountability, everything. Now, it will be unfair if I let people, or if I see people doing something that isn't right, and I just let it go so that somebody doesn't say I'm being a chauvinist. Now I speak up and people say, just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let it go, because if I let it go, I have not shown love to this person. You know, like, I try to bring in every aspect of life to this. You can't just exist without also... I'm a Christian and I can't just exist without God totally neglecting my faith. And by my Christian faith, it says love your neighbor. If you go to 1 Corinthians 13, mm-hmm. one of the attributes of love, they said love is patient, it is kind, it's not irritable, not resentful, not arrogant, not rude. Love does not exist on its own way. Love does not rejoice with evil.
Evil. Mm-hmm.
So if I see someone doing something wrong and I just keep quiet, I have not shown this my neighbor love. Okay, so telling you this is wrong. So you're not being a feminist. Like, I see you say my body, my choice, and I see you wearing something that I know I wouldn't let my loved one wear, and I tell you what you're wearing is not right, like, for the occasion that you're wearing it, and you tell me it's your choice, and I'm like, well, your choice is wrong. And people say it's you, is the way you're seeing it. In fact, mm-hmm. you're the problem, mm-hmm. because I wear what I like. And I tell people, so you can't tell what indecent dressing is by wearing it yourself. And they ask me the same question I asked you now. What defines indecent dressing?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, well, you may not understand in the Western world, but in Nigeria, we used to have things called meat. Okay, in Nigeria, house helps. All right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, indecent dressing is that thing that you wouldn't want your 22-year-old female house help with, that is voluptuous, wearing in front of your husband. That's indecent dressing.
Why do you have to bring the house helps into this?
Yeah, because maybe you would understand it better if you know that you're pro wear whatever it is you want. If this 22-year-old voluptuous house help of yours wears the same thing in front of your husband, do not reprimand her. Tell your husband not to look. Tell your husband that he's the problem, that she has the right to wear what she wants. But when that happens, you suddenly change. And then you think, what are you wearing in front of my husband? Then you suddenly realize that she is being indecent. But it's okay for you to do. So somehow we know the truth. We just lie to ourselves. So when you say stuff like this to people, they say you're being a chauvinist. It's the same thing. I'm against anything that is wrong. I'm against crime. I'm against abuse. I'm against discrimination, racism, whatever it is, regardless of the gender.
Yeah. I mean, that said, even though I know that you hold some very strong opinions, I still feel safe with you, in the sense of, you know, I know you're probably one of the first people that would die for my rights and, you know, protect me when needed, if that came to, you know, that. So I'll add that to that. But I think what sparked my bringing you on the podcast, I've been wanting to bring you on the podcast for the longest time. I have put up a post that a friend of mine had shared, which I'm going to read out verbatim, and you disagreed with it. So I want to explore that just a little bit. So it said, this is the reality of some women. There are many women who would love to sit at home and do nothing. Brothers, marry those women and leave ambitious women alone. So women have a calling from God that has nothing to do with the marriage. Stop stopping your wives from being successful. You will answer to God for it someday. If you hinder the work of God through your spouse, you will answer to him when the time comes. And you, my dear friend Ike, goes, I don't agree with that. I do not agree that this is the reason. And I said, tell me more. And I said, you know, hold on. Actually, it's time for you to come on the podcast. So what is your bone of contention with that post?
Well, I think the first line is already wrong, because you try to compare something Okay, let me just reconstruct another sentence for you.
Okay.
You know, like, some of you want to stay at home, and what time do you normally take siesta if you are going to take siesta?
I don't take siesta.
For those that take siesta,
maybe midnight, midday, 12.
Okay, so 12. Okay, so now if you like if you like the sort of person that takes siestas, please go and find the kind of person that takes siestas. For those of us hardworking people who do not take siestas, so by implication, you have already said
excluded.
That the fact that you take siestas makes you a lazy person. So when you talk about ambition, and then you say those women that are stay at home moms, those women that stay at home, they're not just staying at home. It's not, they're not at home because of a lack of ambition. So grouping them as non-ambitious people because they choose to stay at home, and because you wanted to chase your own ambition. What's an ambition, as a matter of fact? An ambition is something you strive to become, something you want to do, something you're passionate about and you're chasing. Being a homemaker is what she's chasing. She wants to be at home. She wants to do this. That's an ambition. Her ambition is to be at home. So why would you say she's not ambitious just because she's not doing, just because she's not doing what you're doing? That's like the first part of the comment that I said, that's not true. Then secondly is, the truth of the matter is, yes, a marriage is supposed to bring out the best in everybody. Everybody's supposed to fulfill, to be fulfilled and achieve their purpose on earth. But then again, it has to be done in such a way that it's synchronized into a single functional unit. If what you're doing is going to break apart that single functional unit, no matter what that thing is, no matter the name you paint it, it is already wrong. Now, I put up a post one time. I don't know if you saw the post where I said, I asked ChatGPT if he was the devil, what he would do.
Oh. Did I don't see remember that? No.
Okay, so I think I'll just see if I still have that. I asked ChatGPT and I said, if you were the devil and you wanted to destroy the world,
what did he say?
It's just told me a bunch of scary things. Now, one of the things he said was that I'm going to, this is ChatGPT, I'm trying to find my phone. It was a WhatsApp status. So I just took some screenshots from that and then I posted it. I deleted a lot of pictures, so I want to know if I still have it.
That's okay.
Or not. So one of the things he said was, I'm going to blur the truth, confuse people from knowing what's right and wrong. That's step one. Normalize things. Let's normalize this. Let's normalize this. Why is this like this? Why is this like this? That's one of the things he said. I'm going to make people focus more on their emotions than logic. Do you get? This is how I feel. This makes me uncomfortable. This is my this. Me. Uncle, auntie, how you feel is how you feel. There are standards. Now, some people will argue who put the standards there. That's a completely different conversation for another day. But depending on where you're coming from, some people will say, oh, okay, I operate under the legal standards. Some people will say, I'm a traditionalist and I go by our traditions and our customs. That's what I use as my standards. Some people will say, oh, okay, I am a Christian or I am a religious person. I'll go by the scriptural, spiritual standards. Some people will say, oh, I'll go by the social, whatever standards you want to use, stick to that standard. I have chosen to go by the scriptural, spiritual standards. And by the standards, it means that when there is a conflict of interest, we go back and visit the standard. What does the standard have to say about this? Okay, so part of what ChatGPT was saying was it was going to obligate that standard so that people don't even know what the truth is anymore. So the truth will just be a matter of perception, a matter of whatever it is you
My
think
truth,
it is.
Your there truth,
can,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there can be two truths, of which I am a firm believer that there can't be two truths on the same subject. it's not possible. People have argued this and said, oh, it's about emotional maturity. If you cannot just understand that there can be two angles to the same thing. No, there aren't. If you're on this angle and there is, we cannot be seeing the same thing. It's not that. And there can't be two truths, same thing, logically. A lot of people will have a lot of things to say about this. In fact, one of the things I said is a friend of mine sent me a picture, a meme, where two people were standing across a number. The number was something that looked like a six. But from this person's perspective, nine. It looked like a nine. And this person, and he said, true. You know, so it's a matter of... And I said, no, it's not. Why? Because that number on the floor is not a six and a nine at the same time. One of these two people, they are either both wrong or one is wrong and one is right. Or they are both wrong, but they cannot be both right.
Both right,
it may
yeah.
not be a 6 or a 9. It might actually be letter G. Okay? Small letter G. But
only one person can be right. Yeah.
Only one person can be right here. And how do you now know who is right? You go back to the standard. First of all, is who puts this letter on the floor?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you look around the environment. If you look around, you may see 1, 2, 3, 4 written on the floor somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then you see this. And then after that, there's a 7. I mean, common sense, being a common sense advocate should tell you this is a letter 6, number 6, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the other person just assumed from what, there is a conflict of interest, if there is a controversy surrounding a particular issue, you go back to a certain standard. Mm-hmm. And that standard will now tell you what that thing is and what to do. So it's not a matter of how you feel about it. It's a matter of right and wrong, and it cannot be two truths at once. Now, people have become very comfortable in setting standards based on how they feel, which is what ChatGPT said, that if you were to be the devil. Oh, again, he said, the family structure. I'm going to disrupt the family structure so that people do not understand where is this. I don't want to interrupt your...
Oh, it's okay.
Your podcast, but I wish I would find this. You know, like the day you need something is the day you will never find it.
Right. Do you tag your photos? Do you tag your photos?
No. I think it's one of the things I would have thrown away at some point. I didn't keep it, but
that's okay.
Okay. I think I can find it in a chat somewhere. But okay. So that's what ChatGPT said. So you will see that the way the world works today is exactly what ChatGPT, who should be the most woke person, whoever it is, the AI behind it is, should be the most woke thing ever, still knows that there is something wrong with the system. I don't want to completely say everything he wrote, because it may trigger some people. I have seen it. Okay.
Okay, good.
Do you mind if I read it out? So I said,
sure, you can read it out.
I said, if you were to be the devil, how would you destroy the young minds of the next generation without them even knowing it? And it answered, he said, that's a deep and unsettling question, but a powerful one. If I were to think like the devil, the goal would be to be subtle, long-term manipulation. And here's how it might play out. Number one, normalize instant gratification. This is basic. Encourage constant dopamine hits through social media, short videos, and endless notifications, rewiring brains to crave quick rewards and making patience or deep thinking feel intolerable. Number two, confuse identity. I'll undermine clear, grounded sense of self. I'll push extremes of identity confusion and conflicts so that young people are always questioning who they are and they will never find out stable answers. Number three, I'll devalue the truth. I'll blur the line between facts and opinion. I'll promote a culture where feelings outweigh logic, and where every truth is relative to the point that nothing can be trusted anymore. Number four, I will glorify vanity. I will make self-worth dependent on likes, follows, or beauty. I will shift value from character and purpose to appearance and validation. I will weaken families. out subtly erode the value of strong family units, stable relationships, and mentorship. I'll replace them with peer culture and algorithms. I'll mock virtue, make morality look outdated or lean, replace culture with clout, wisdom, wisdom with sarcasm, and kindness with performative activism. Promote numbness, use entertainment, porn, substance abuse, endless distractions to dull emotional sensitivity, blah, blah, making it hard to feel real joy. There's a whole lot. It was just so much.
Yeah.
But the truth is, this is what, you know, like, just take out the truth and take out the source of the truth as well. If you take out the source of the truth and take out the truth, everybody does what they want. And now, if you now speak up the truth, and just like you said, I'll make morality look obsolete. I'll make common sense look obsolete. You come up and tell someone something that is, you know, this is just wrong.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Back to my very first question I asked you about that particular post. I get where you're coming from. And I agree with you that it might be perceived as that absolutism where if a woman tries to stay at home, then she's not ambitious, right? But the person who posted it, I can also see this other side of it where, you know, tradition sometimes can become a trap. You know, if you marry a woman with vision and who tries, and you try to clip her wings in name of structure or submission, that is not mature decision making. If you even want to take it back to the Bible, like the woman from Proverbs 31, she was both business savvy and family oriented. So I don't think ambition is not unbiblical. I think it's misalignment and ego and that causes disturbance. And in this particular case, I want to believe that the author was really speaking to men who, you marry somebody, you see the ambition in them, you know that they're destined for greatness, but because you aren't comfortable in your own leadership, you try to clip their wings and you derail them. That is what I think the author is talking about.
Yeah, I understand, but I still have a problem with the word ambition. Just say
submission or ambitious.
As ambition, the terminology ambition, I would rather say somebody that is more white collar career path.
Yeah.
Not ambition. Ambition can be whatever it is.
Anyone can have ambition regardless of career. Yes.
So just say this career, this type of career, people that have this type of outside the house type of career, not ambition. Ambition is not the word. But okay, these sort of people, mind you, it's not just the man just didn't marry the wife. The wife also married the man. They got married. They were married. So at a point, this is why I'm a very, you know, like, this is not something you say in the Western world. They will throw me stone. But the truth is, the Bible makes it clear that a man should love his wife, a wife should submit to the husband. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the truth of the matter is, whatever submission that is starts from the marriage, but nobody can pick a husband for you. Nobody should pick a husband for you. And you, it lies on you as a woman to know the type of man that you're going to marry, because these are conversations you would have. Nobody becomes ambitious in marriage. An ambitious woman was ambitious from secondary school. She was class prefect. She was school prefect. She was in university. She was in every society, every group. She was the, you would see ambition. Yeah. She just doesn't get into marriage and suddenly becomes ambitious. So whoever it is that is marrying you would have dated you or been with you or known you long enough to know that this is who you are. Now, what did he do at those times? He would have started, okay, let's just say now, that a colleague of mine who is here in the UK wants to get married to a lady in Nigeria. This is a very political lady. This is the sort of thing she wants. She likes politics. She already has an APC ticket. She's there going for all the conventions and all that. And then this doctor guy in the UK is telling her, okay, so when we move to the UK in, you know, I mean, you cannot be doing Nigerian politics from the UK here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you hear these things. And then, you know, this is what this guy is thinking.
I still go ahead and marry him.
And you still go ahead and marry the guy. And then you come here, you have one child, you say you want to go back to Nigeria, and you know, like, you're disrupting the family unit. A family has been formed at that point in time. So, like I said, whatever it is you're doing that is detrimental to that family unit, which, mind you, the devil, put an unquote, ChatGPT here, did not mention anything about career. He mentioned family unit. If that thing you're doing is going to disrupt the family unit, it's already wrong. Okay? So, if you can manage, there are women who have done fantastic jobs in having fantastic careers and still you for one. Yes, and you still have a family. Nothing says that. Now, again, why does the man want you home? Why is he trying to clip your wings, quote unquote?
We'll never know. Sometimes they have different reasons for that. And we can can pick stories that might fit this narrative, but this sometimes it might also be a matter of manipulation and control.
Exactly. Now, the truth is, this is a case by case basis.
Yes, exactly.
Basis. Do you understand? Because sometimes it's affecting the family. Sometimes it's just
an unhealthy competition. Yeah.
Competition, inferiority complex, ego, and even insecurities too. Do you understand? And ego, by, you know, like your wife is getting more admiration than you are, and then you feel. Sometimes it's just insecurities. You just see her. I mean, some women just like to look good when they go to work. And then you're like, these men are going to be looking. And it's just for 1 million and 10 reasons. And then because of that, you want to like stop something that's crazy. So I wouldn't say that a woman should know. I am pro. You know me. I am pro. My partner was the best graduating student of her class. She's a medical doctor. You know that I said I wasn't going to talk about this subject, but
yeah,
that's she's as when you're talking about career, she's up there. You know, like a lot of people who don't even know will think that we pity who you're going to marry. Oh, I am the number one. Like if I had bonbons, what do you call like
the talking drum?
Like every day I'm going to be at work, give me an E, give me an this, I'm her biggest fan and the cheerleader.
I didn't expect anything less from you.
I support everything sometimes if she has like an exam to write, we are there, we did it together, we are pushing and I'm like, go out there, do this. And I'm supporting.
As it should be.
Why? As it should be. That's the why. Because it's to the glory of the entire
family unit.
Units, exactly. It's not detrimental. Now, if something were to be detrimental, we would. My point is, people have argued and said stuff like, a man will sacrifice. It's not true. It's not always true. A man will sacrifice himself for the family. A woman will sacrifice the family for her comfort. I'm sure you've heard stuff like that before. Right? Now, let's know that we are always going to prioritize the family. So, whatever it is we are going to do, the end result of this should be the betterment of the family. Is this going to hurt the family system? If it is, then we may need to tailor. It may not be the extremes, like, I'm a career person, I'm ambitious and I want to do this, and they tell you no, come and sit down in the house and go to the other room and be no, that's not what we're talking about here. Do you understand? Maybe we may just need to. I have seen women on the other hand who tell their husbands, you know, you can't take this job. You can't just go to work in the morning by 8 o'clock and come back by 10 PM every night and just leave me and the kids. Can't you just find a way of adjusting this so that you can come home and spend some time with the family? I mean, when a woman does this, nobody says she's keeping the husband's wings. When the man keeps missing the children's birthdays, the children's football games, missing important activities in the house because he keeps traveling now for one business, he's made out to look like an asshole. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast, but he's made out to look like
that's come out of my mouth, don't worry.
He's made out to look like a very terrible person, okay?
Yeah.
And the woman says, make some time for your family. You can't be doing this job. You can't just go and take another contract in Japan and then you're living for 6 months again. She's the victim. Everybody's understanding her. Everybody's saying, guy, you'll be chasing money, and you'll neglect your family. Okay, it's a man thing. The woman does the exact same thing. The man says, you cannot keep doing this. Oh, you're trying to clip my wings. It's your ego. You cannot handle a strong black woman. You cannot, I mean, come on, this is exactly what I'm talking about. The double standards. It doesn't mean he's trying to clip your wings. He's trying to say, let's prioritize what should be priority. That's not priority. Your career is a you thing. It's not priority. It's good. It's something that we should celebrate. It's something that we should be happy about. But it's not, it doesn't come before this. The family is the first thing that comes into play. So if whatever it is you're going to do at the end of the day will lead to a... In fact, I've heard women tell their friends, if the man is not supporting that, leave him, take the kids, or even leave the kids with him. So you're willing to break up the most important thing in our lives for whatever it is. Is that too big sacrifice to make? Do you get? Now, what you could do is, okay, babe, I really want to do this. Can we work around this? Let's find a way. I also believe if we have been able to put a piece of metal that weighs thousands of tons and suspends 300 people inside it that is flying near the speed of sound, way over the clouds, and we put it up there and we fly into this outer space and go to the moon, and you and I are in two different continents seeing each other and talking, we have done marvelous things in terms of technology.
Yeah.
I don't think that something as simple as this will not have a solution. Everything has a way around it. Everything has a solution. If you put your mind to it, if you don't, first of all, bring in conflicts, because the first thing is going to be you feel the confrontation and then the resistance, the rebellion starts, conflicts escalates and everything breaks apart. You sit down, somebody has told you what his concern is. I think this is harming the unit. And then you bring your case, how it's not harming the unit and how we fix whatever it is that is the problem. I mean, why is it okay for women to want 20,000 validations in a day? You make your hair, your husband doesn't tell you you're looking fine, and then he's not a good person. You make your nails and he's supposed to find it and compliment your nails. You need reassurance, steady reassurance. You need to be told you're loved. You need to be told you're beautiful. And your man needs you to just let him know that this is not going to go wrong. And then it's an ego thing. He's insecure. He cannot handle it. I mean, why do we have these standards?
Okay, so again, we can talk in absolute terms because there are many variations to this story. But one thing I know for sure is that we have to acknowledge that men are often speaking from a place of structural and even cultural privilege, right? Even when they don't mean to. Because if you think about it, in many of our cultures, women are taught from one day, they want to shrink themselves, to be agreeable, to be quiet, to be self-sacrificing. That's just what you've been taught from day one. And when you dare to dream...
Is it our culture?
Well, I want to just speak to my culture, you know. I mean, I think maybe generally everywhere, but I'll just speak for my culture because that's what I know.
Do you have your phone with you?
I have my phone with me, yeah.
Can you open your Bible?
Oh, hold on. Let me finish this thought on it. I have my Bible. I have my app. Yeah, what's up? What do you want
okay,
to
Okay, so just let's quickly just do this. Do 1 Timothy chapter 2.
Okay, where am I now? 1 Timothy 2, okay.
Start from verse 12.
Hold on.
Could you read that for
you? Okay, hold on.
1 Timothy 2 verse 12. Yeah, read that for your viewers.
What version are you looking for? What I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet.
It's not just our culture, my dear.
Oh,
it's
Jesus also Christ. Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, okay. Why? Let me just say that this is assuming that everyone really believes in, you know, scriptural marriages. No, I'm speaking generally here, right?
Yeah,
and I'm glad
that
you brought that. Context matters, right? And I'm glad you brought that up because I'm actually I love Paul. And I think Paul was writing to a specific church in Ephesus when he did this, where false teachings were being spread, mainly by uneducated women who had just begun to have access to public life. So it wasn't a universal ban on women teaching. It was a temporary corrective for a specific issue. And we also have to remember that Paul affirmed women in leadership elsewhere. Like he commended Priscilla, you know, who was a woman who taught Apollos a man. He called them, and I've done a series on Paul. For me was a feminist.
No. I have not.
Context matters. You like, just like said like I told you quiet, but that's from context.
No. You said, now in some cultures, I can also tell you some cultures. I mean, look at Sinto Natasha Fabio. She's a senator. She's leading over people, and she was voted from the grassroots. It was a culture, aside from the culture, from her place where she was voted from. So there are a lot of cultures that also push women to be at the top and lead and all that. Context matters as well. What I'm trying to tell you is that you made it look like this was very peculiar to the traditional aspect. And I said it's not peculiar to traditional customs. It's also scriptural. It's also, in fact, legally, there's some level of this to, okay, the fact that the woman is going to be this. There are certain privileges that are accorded to a woman in a legal setting. You don't. When a property is registered in the name of the man and the wife, and you guys have an issue, the courts will order the man to leave. In the case of a separation, the man leaves the property for the woman. Why? Because the court sees her as what? The weaker person. The man, you can survive, you can do this. That was not the premise. That's happened. It's not like they don't tip a coin and all every other time it lands on the head and they tell the man to leave. No, even legally, there is some privilege accorded to woman for being a woman. So there is no absolute equality anywhere, scripturally, culturally, customarily, nowhere. Let's just know that it's not peculiar to customs alone. Now, that's not to say that I have an issue with, no, I am pro, like I said, pro. I have been pro everything women. Don't get me wrong.
No, but it's you bringing out Paul's letter to the Ephesians. It's like bringing somebody's email and making it a constitutional law.
All I just wanted to say was, it's not peculiar to our custom.
Okay, I'm like speaking said, about Nigerian. I'm talking about our culture as Nigerians. Like, women are taught to be, you know, to quiet down. And when I say quiet down, it's not meant to be quiet. There's a self-sacrificial nature that you're, you know, embedded with. And I'm going back to that message that I shared with you on WhatsApp. I think it comes to when, you know, again, families, you make your family. Balance is something you decide for yourself. We have instances here where, for example, the husband stays at home and takes care of the kids, and they live off of maybe the wife's salary. That's something that works for them. Maybe the wife is in a position where she can do better jobs. Because if two people are working in this part of our world, you have to think about childcare. And the money for childcare can be quite, you know, a lot. Yeah. So they make that sacrifice. Okay, you go work and I'll take care of the kids. I don't see the man as less than a man, right? You don't see the man and say, oh, he's being lazy. The wife is the one working. That's what works for them. Again, I'm speaking to in instances where this particular spouse, especially the man, is trying to limit the grace of God in the woman's life because he feels very, very threatened by that calling of God. That's what I'm speaking to specifically. We can talk about generalists. I feel like we agree on so many things.
Okay, so we're going to come back to this, but I'm going to stand by. Now, this man that has decided and said, oh, okay, you're better suited to do this work. In this instance, I'm better suited to take care of this family and be at home. Does that mean the man is not an ambitious person?
Oh, he's ambitious. I mean, I think it's fantastic because if you think about it, children should be with.
Now, if this show were to be reversed and the man says, oh, I think I'm better suited to do this, and I think in this context you're better suited to do this, it's not like the man is not capable of doing other things. He's very capable of doing other things. He just had to not do those things because in this particular instance, the family has to be together. Somebody has to take care of the kids. Somebody has to do this. So let's just arrange the duties to suit everybody. I know other things I can do, but let me just limit this part and do this part. You can also want to be at home and be a mommy, but do this part. You're better suited for it. And then everybody plays their role and takes some form of inconvenience at some point. Now, it is a functional system. If the roles were reversed and the man says, oh, okay, you're better suited to do this for the sake of the family, all of a sudden, if the woman accepts it, her peers will call her unambitious. If she decides to do this, she is the person. But let's just leave that part. That's just for us.
But people will always talk. I'm not going to knock that out. As long as both of them agree. Again, I'm all about choices. As long as both of them agree. There are instances where you might even see a spouse doing one thing that...
Yeah, the post said, go and marry that woman who will agree with you. Leave us that are ambitious. So her agreement with you means she is not ambitious. Let's start with what the post said. Where I started, and I was thrown up already.
Yeah, yeah. If you get to
the part where you say women are pushed to be silent, how? How?
Okay. Please. Okay. Again, when I go back to this, I always talk about, you know, again, this particular scenario that I'm highlighting from that message where I read it is, I don't think the problem is tradition. I think it's when tradition becomes a trap. When someone marries a woman who with vision and tries to clip her wings in the name of structure or submission, that's not mature decision making. I feel that's witchcraft. That's control. The post isn't saying that all men are oppressive. It's saying if you don't want to go alongside
an ambitious woman,
then don't marry one. Choose differently. Don't choose her and then punish her for being who she is. Simple.
Let's use. If she's not ambitious, she can't be punished by the man. But let's use a case study. Like, say, okay. Imagine a 27-year-old man marrying a 24-year-old woman who does this, and then this woman says this, and then the man says, let's use a case so that it would understand better.
Sorry, say again.
let's use.
Okay, let's just say two people get married, right?
Okay.
And I mean, there's so many variables. I just feel like I can pick a side and you can pick a side, and then I can pitch a tent and say this is how it's supposed to be. All I'm just saying that in that context, and you can read it that way, and you're okay to read it that way, you're reading it. Because also come from your own position as a man and the experience that you have shaped you, and vice versa.
Let's create this fictional couple.
Okay, you give me the modalities.
Okay, so this man is 35, married to this lady, she's 30, okay?
Yeah.
And now they are together. The lady is what is the career path that she's taking that the man is trying to take?
Well, let's say she wants to be a traveling minister.
Okay, so she wants to be a traveling minister, okay?
Yeah.
And then the man, they live somewhere, and then the man doesn't want her. Why does he not want that?
We don't know. It could be many reasons. Again, I'm speaking to when you know that you're not doing it because of the family, when there's ego involved. That's what I'm speaking to.
Do you think, now, again, let's leave the part where I say I am a human rights activist. A human rights activist means that I want everybody to be judged on the same platform.
Yeah.
Let's not have double standards, which I've been saying. Now let's move to the common sense part, where I say I'm also a common sense advocate. Now this is common sense. Do you think someone whose ambition is to be a traveling minister, whatever that job means, or whatever the job, actually wants to be a wife? You want to be a traveling minister and you want to be a wife?
It's possible, why not?
It sounds like an oxymoron to me. Because, I mean,
what if the husband was a traveling minister?
Okay, first of all, please, sorry.
You wouldn't marry one.
Let me not internationally display my ignorance. What's a traveling minister? Because it doesn't sound...
Like a minister. It could be a minister of God who travels from one place to another place to go and minister to God.
Oh, traveling minister. Oh, okay.
Yeah, not a minister of travel.
Oh, okay. But you have to, how often do you travel?
You move around. Okay, we can keep coming up with permutations and combinations. I'm speaking to the specifics of you're not doing this for a family.
If you want to be a traveling minister, why do you want to get married?
Then don't leave the person. That's why I say leave the person and marry somebody else. Aren't you back to the same topic that we just started talking about? Maybe she's not the wife for you. Marry someone that doesn't want to be a travel minister. You clearly saw that she was building her ministry portfolio before you married her. All of a sudden, she gets married to you and it becomes a problem. That is what I'm speaking to. And we've come back full circle to this particular conversation again.
No. If this is the angle you're taking, I am fully with you. Okay? If you saw her building this portfolio, like I said, nobody becomes ambitious, quote unquote, in marriage.
Let's just end this conversation. We agree.
So you saw her doing this.
Yes.
You had no qualms with it.
No.
You never mentioned it. You never had any issues with it.
No.
Then all of a sudden, when it's now becomes fruitful and then she needs to start traveling, you suddenly have an issue with it and you tell her, no. Yes. That I do not agree with, because this woman married you on the grounds that you are okay with this thing that she is doing. So you don't let her invest her time, her resources, her brain work, and she got to this point only for you to come and tell her that she can no longer do it anymore. That's wrong.
I agree. That's exactly what I've been talking about since. So marry somebody that would fit your goals and carry them along.
What I agree, where I had an issue was a new goal.
No,
spring something up on this person and say, so the Holy Spirit told me last night that I should have this new passion, and then you have to be okay with it. Now this is going to happen. Now this man already knew that this was coming. So whatever it is that is happening, if there is a new issue that is, you know, like we said, a case-to-case basis, if there's a new issue, let's just say, in this scenario where people have kids with special needs, and you know, like the man says, so you see, we have this problem,
we need to limit this.
You know, this is a new issue that was out of their control, but not when you both agreed. You saw her doing this, like even in the relationship, you saw this happening, and then all of a sudden, you're no longer comfortable with it anymore. No, that's completely wrong. I was talking about a new, like springing something up. We are married. No, no, I don't know. No, so you decide that you want to go and become a traveling minister.
No, no, no. That's not how that premise.
No, on this, exactly. On this, I agree.
Yes. I mean, I had a friend who was working at a multinational company, was making a lot of money. The guy knew about it, and everything was great. She was even speaking a foreign language, which really helped her to go up the ranks. And they get married, and he told her to quit the job.
No, you cannot do that because you are going against... This is a verbal contract of
that
some sort.
That is the premise I was bringing up.
This is a verbal contract. Now, no, we are just talking about it from two different angles, because if we have, like, let's just say we're dating and we're trying to get married, and then in the course of our relationship, we are planning a family together. You have your secret goals and plans that you've not told me about.
We have agreed
that this is how we're going to run a family, and then all of a sudden you spring something up, and then the man is saying, no, you cannot do this because this is not what we planned. And you say, why would you let me do this? But I just developed this new passion. And then there's no way to walk around it, because like I said, there's always room to walk around it.
There's no way to walk around it, and
you need to have the family units. Fine. But if you beforehand, you also had this verbal contract where you are doing this, the man sees, in fact, you don't even have to tell him, he sees you doing that, like I said. A woman that is ambitious, you see it from primary school, from secondary school, you see her, she's doing this, she's talking about her goals, this is what you people discuss when you go out to have dinner, and she tells you about all these things, and you know this is what she wants to do. And then you seem to be okay with it, then suddenly you marry her, then you now remember that Timothy said that Paul wrote to this thing that they should not. No, you don't do that. You are the one that is breaching the contract.
Okay, so I'm glad that we're able to come to a point of agreement. All right, we spent a lot of time on this. Quickly before you go, let's go back to your dad, right? And again, once again, sorry for your loss. I'm curious to know, what is one thing people get wrong about grief, especially when it's a man grieving?
I used to think everybody in my house that we were all immortal. We've never experienced a death in the family. This was the first time. And I honestly did not know how to grieve. I was scared that I was grieving wrong. I did not shed one tear from then till date. And it bothered me so much that I wouldn't even cry. But I couldn't get myself to cry, and I thought, am I doing it wrong? Is there something I'm supposed to do? How do people just wail when such things happen? But considering the circumstances surrounding my dad's death, if my dad were to wish for his own death, if he were supposed to like write how you want to die, it couldn't have been penned down any better. That's exactly how he would have wanted to die. My dad always told me, please, whatever it is you do, he will say to Igbo, don't go and die in a foreign land, though. Come and grow old in your country and die. Surprisingly, he just came back to Nigeria. He wasn't even in Enugu. He was in my hometown, in his bedroom, with his prayer. My dad is a very spiritual, prayerful guy. And he was just there, and he just finished saying his prayer, folded his hands on his chest, with his prayer book in his chest, laid down, slept, and died on his bed. In the village, exactly where, like, he just came back from my brother, just came and died on his bed peacefully. There was no time my dad needed aids to go to the bathroom. My dad was never on the catheter, he was never wearing that, you know, like, he was just an active man, did everything. He spoke to all of us on video call within the past 24 hours of his death. The grandchildren, in fact, the time I spoke to him, it was with the grandchildren, my sister's kids, so his grandchildren. He spoke to every single person, and it was just so I just felt he was happy. And I told myself, what would my dad want me to do right now? Would he want me? I mean, you can't say, oh, this is a celebration of life, and then you're crying. I mean, they say, you're supposed to cry. I know he's happy. No, he's in a happy, a better place. I believe that within me. Now, when you're grieving, there is no formula to grieving. Just grieve. If crying is what you want to do, if taking some time to yourself is what you want to do, if at that point in time you're allowed to grieve, people around you should show you support. And I don't think there's any weakness or any... It's your grieving. your grieving is that you're grieving. Men grieve too. Men are more emotional than people would want to believe. Okay, so grief is a very difficult time for people. Just do whatever it is, however it is, it works for you. There is no one way to grieve. Yes, yeah. some people have grieved by you see them at work, they just become rebellious. Mm-hmm. And they are just doing, and this person is just going through a lot. Some people just become withdrawn. Some people just become all tearful. Some people become excessively happy. Mm-hmm. Fakely happy. They are just drinking and they are all doing whatever it is, trying to repress this emotion as much as it is. But I would just advise you, don't do anything on health. Just let it go. Pray about it. Be open and let your body handle it the way. The human body has an excellent way of reacting to certain kind of stimuli, be it internal, be it external. Your body is going to handle it. So if your body pushes you, you know, like how you're pregnant and the baby wants is craving, in the middle of the night. Yes.
Yeah.
So pregnancy happens differently for different people.
Yeah.
You get. That's how grief. So however it is, your body, whatever it is, your body grieves at that point in time. It wants to let it. That's not the time to try to risk. You can restrict your body when it comes to indulgences, when it comes to certain things that you want, you know, like for discipline sake, you can train your body not to be indisciplined. Grief is not one of the times you train your body. Grief is one of the times you let your body have its way. If he wants to cry, he cries. If he wants to sleep, he sleeps. If he wants to be depressed, allow it.
That's a bit. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. If you could have one more conversation with your dad, what would you say to him?
I said it to him. That's why I was happy. I saw my dad. I was in Nigeria. I was in Nigeria a few weeks before my dad died. He came to Nigeria the same day I was in Nigeria. I was in Lagos. We met in Lagos. Or rather, I was leaving Nigeria the day he was coming into Nigeria. I was leaving Nigeria and then he was coming in. So we met in Lagos. So he told me to come and see him. And then he prayed for me. He poured one full bottle of anointing oil on me. And he was like, you know, I didn't know that was the last time we were going to see him. In fact, I ran back to my hotel room, drenching anointing oil. And then at some point, he was telling me something. He was saying, you know, like just giving me advice, you know, like father's like, we don't get to see often because he lives in a different continent. I live in a different continent. So we just happened to see. And I actually delayed so that we will see, because there was no way we would just miss each other by one day. He will come back to Nigeria and I will leave. So I delayed and stayed back in Nigeria. So he landed and then we saw. So during that conversation, he was saying that, and he was, my dad is, nothing is ever enough. So he kept on trying to say, you know, this could have happened, this could have happened, this, like, all that could have happened, you know, like he's still looking back in the past, like, oh, he could have done this, this could have happened and all that. And I was like, you were the best. Nobody has done it. Like I said, that's the most emotional I am my dad we've ever gotten. Little did I know I was going to see him. That was the last time. And I said, you were the best. You couldn't have done it any better. And you did a good job. And I, as much as you would want to laugh right now, I was like, look at me. I'm your son. And I think I'm the worst of the other three. The other three are all, they're all fine, doing well. One is there with you in the US. The other one is here with me in the UK. Yeah, and your kids are doing well. Your everything you prayed for. There are so many parents that will look at our family structure and this is their dream. This is what they prayed their children will become. How many doctors do you have in your house? How many people, like, all your kids are doing well? Doing okay. You're happy, your wife is here, everybody loves you, you're loved, you're a very respected person. Like, you have achieved things that most people wouldn't achieve coming from where you came from. You lived a very fulfilled life. Very fulfilled life. You don't have to think, like, if you die today, maybe you died a great man.
You told him that?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
And I told him, yes, if you die today, you died a great man. Even if it's today. So you're not, I don't know what is, what are you chasing? Like, your kids are all, like, everybody's okay. In Igbo, like I said, years ago, okay, you have trained your children and you did it right. You have worked hard. You've done things that most parents could not do. You made sacrifices that most parents would not make. And at the same time, you lived a righteous life at the same time. You're in the top 0.001%. And somehow, I was saying that to make him stop. This is the time to relax. Let's come and take care of you. You understand? You shouldn't still be thinking of what to do and what stuff. Yes, what to achieve. No. Mm-hmm. Relax. You've done it all. And we said, and after we prayed, he poured that whole bottle of anointing on you, like, what is it? Yeah, and so while I was in the Uber, like, the Uber guy kept on looking at me like I was a crazy person. I didn't want to shower. I just left it on my body that whole night. Let it just sink in.
Yeah.
And that was it. And we left. And then we talked. And then we continued talking. How is Nigeria? And then till the day. In fact, the day before, we still talked. And then the next month,
he passed away.
He passed away.
How old was he?
Yeah. He was 76.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. As we wrap up this Father's Day series, you know, what advice would you have for younger men who are trying to be good sons, good fathers, or even good humans in a rapidly changing world?
Father knows best. Yeah, that's a line from a song from...
I know. Are you not assuming that they have fathers in their life? What if they don't have fathers in their lives?
Find the father who knows best. Yeah, but the truth is, as a young man, I have heard people say that they are depressed. Like, mental health is a very, you know, touchy subject that I wouldn't want to get into. But I've seen 16-year-olds feel unaccomplished in life.
That's too young. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Don't be in a rush. You're not in a hurry. You have your whole life ahead of you. Enjoy every bit of your life and do not make a mistake that is irreversible. Don't go and do something that you cannot reverse. Some of us, we are products of luck, because on our own stupid day, we weren't, I wouldn't tell you that we were particularly the most, or would celebrate people all through our lives. Maybe at some point you could have knocked somebody up, the person pulled you down with a baby, you would have, like, life would have gone a whole lot of ways.
We are just
lucky and just managed to get. But the truth is, don't rush anything. It's going to come to you. Put these few things first. First of all, is like your love for God, your love for your family, appreciate education, respect humanity and respect people, and love yourself. If you have these five traits,
you'll be good. Okay.
So once you love God and have a good relationship with God, love your family, have a good relationship with your family, love and respect people, your elders and people.
Yeah.
Appreciate education and know that the need for education is not a scam. It is so not a scam. And because people say education is a scam, a lot of people now tend to turn away from education and put their hands in a whole lot of rubbish. Yahoo, OnlyFans, just you're doing crap. I mean, just understand the importance of education. And then also love yourself. If you love yourself, you're going to respect yourself. If you respect yourself,
So if your children were to listen to this 20 years down the line, what would you hope they say about you on the podcast? Or if they listened to you and came on the podcast to talk about you, what would you hope they say about you on the podcast episode?
That I did good and they were proud of me.
What does good mean?
Like, they're not, like, I was a good father and they're proud of me. Fathers don't get a dot of love. If they will say, we love you. And they are not just saying it's like they meant it and I saw it in their eyes, I would have be a happy person.
Okay. All right. I think it's my last question, I promise. What part of today's conversation surprised you the most?
The fact that at some point we agreed.
only took like 20 minutes. It's not like for the sake of agreement. It's just that I know you have a lot of opinions about things. And it was also a way of me even hearing myself talk to somebody who knows me, you know, to a degree, and see if some of these values that I hold are still tenable. But also taking it back to what the Bible says, because again, I can have opinions about things, but what does it matter if it's not, you know, as a Christian, that is, if it's not going back to that objective standard, you know? So I'm glad that we're able to come to an agreement of some sort on this particular issue. But I know there are some issues that we'll never see eye to eye, but that's okay. Anything you want to say before I close us off? But it was really been quite a I'll save my thank you for next after you. But is there anything you want to say?
No, I'm good. It was really nice talking to you. It was actually really interesting. Really interesting. I should have done this earlier.
Right. And so it's been 15 years.
Maybe we should, like, is there like a policy, like a one tenure kind of?
No.
Yes,
no.
On your show.
No. Huh? No. I mean, you might be a resident male feminist, although I'm always very worried about people who call themselves male feminists. If anything, they tend to hide a lot of stuff. Maybe you might end up proving me wrong, that male feminists are two things that can coexist, like two truths that can coexist. So you can be a resident male feminist. Anytime we have like big issues and the family line, we can bring you as a, you know, what does this mean? Like, explain to us, like, we're five.
I'd love to that's something I am passionate about.
Also
be on the show.
So it's been 15 years since we met, and we've had touch points in between then. Would you say what changes would you say you've seen in me, if any, 15 years ago and then now?
Not much, just same old funny. Well, there has been it's just you, like, this is where I hoped you would be today.
Okay.
It's all that I knew, because I know that you were not going to settle for anything less than what you had to say. And even a few days ago, you sent me something that we were both really happy about and really proud of. And that's just a starting point. And you're just going to keep going. I'm not surprised. Like, there's nothing about you today that surprises me. Maybe something that may not be said on air. But then again, besides that, you came off a bit more conservative.
Really?
In the past, but you turned out to be as woke as, no, let me not say woke, as liberal. You turned out to be a whole lot more liberal than I thought, and I'm like,
I don't know if liberalism is the way, but I'm a people person, you know.
Yes, you are a people person.
I see the values of tradition. I value those parts of it, but the parts that tend to fix people down, I want to talk about them and, you know, challenge those thoughts just for the sake of us being traditional. But I don't call myself a liberal. I'm somewhere in between, but I always put people first over like rules, or I'm people-centered.
One of the things I admire the most about you, I told you, it was an inappropriate joke. You can edit it out the show if you want.
I'm not, by the way, because I want to hear.
I told you, wow, a black lady who speaks Korean with a white kid. I mean, it doesn't work. Like, she's African, she speaks Korean, she has a Caucasian child, and
I've never even thought of myself that way. But now that you say, I can't even unsee it.
You know, like, these are things that are just, you know, like,
but it feels normal. It feels very normal. Speak,
exactly, it feels normal to you, and that's you. That's who you are, and that's the beautiful thing about you. And I admire that so much. And I told you, this might be an inappropriate joke, but
it's not inappropriate. You've broken the fourth wall, as a way.
Only Tolani can pull this off and do it, and then it feels actually, you know, that's who she is.
Okay? You're very kind.
And I love that about you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for showing up with your feels of, you know, today. Your wits, your edge, your grief, your clarity. This was a rich and rowdy conversation. And I thank you for reminding me just what it's like to, like, push the envelope a little bit. That conversations are not just, you know, always simple. They are also necessary. I love just your take on grief. You know, you reminded us that masculinity, like medicine, needs constant diagnosis and treatment, and that grief can be loud or quiet, you know, but never fake. and that common sense may not be common, but make sure it makes for a great podcast episode, which I think this will be. And thank you for reminding us that friendship can survive differences, distances, and even, you know, time that has lapsed between both of us. And yeah, and then even though it was a messy one, I think we can still hold love and disagreements in the same space, although we came back full circle. So to everyone listening, this was part of our Father's Day series, a tribute to the dads we've had, the ones we've lost, and the fathers we hope to be. And we hope that you keep taking care of yourself. And to those that are grieving, our hearts are with you. And like Dr. Okoro said, just take whatever you can. Don't do anything unhealthy. But grief is never linear. If you want to cry or, you know, be exuberant, maybe fly off a plane in a very, very wholesome way, just do whatever it takes to, you know, acknowledge that grief that you're going through. And until next time on the podcast, where all of our identities get a seat on the mic, and when your voice is too loud, too soft, or too complicated to be heard, I remain your host, Mo, and thanks for joining us today. Thanks, Ike. This was really great. You should come back again. If you find a post that I think will make for a great conversation, maybe one of your thesis with ChatGPT, of which I want to do a podcast episode on you about what the future is going to look like, you know, IoT, Internet 5.0, and all of that. That'll be nice.
That'll be really nice.
Where can people find you? Right. Maybe even do like a bit of a on-screen demonstration. Where can people find you for those who might be looking for you or trying to reconnect? Oh, I remember that guy from Ebonyi State. Do you want to be found?
Yeah, of course. AIKAY_OKORO. That's my Instagram page. It's it's private, but if you send me a friend request, I would surely accept. My name is Ikechi Okoro on Facebook, and
it's a very generic name, though. There's so many Ikechi Okoro, because Ikechi is a popular Igbo name. Okoro is like
unfortunately, if you search it, you're going to see a whole lot. But if you saw my face, like, it's a headshot that is there, and you just go to a couple of Ikechi Okoros and then
you find them. I remember your Benz, your gold Benz in Ibaro. How many? I had a tiny Micra, and there came this huge Benz. what a wonderful memory! Thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your
That's
week.
That's lovely. And if anybody that knows me and recognizes me wants to connect to me, they can always go through you, and then
I'm fine too. Yeah, I'm fine too. All right then. Take care. Send me well to your partner, by the way. You call her that, even though I know her by something else, but I'll use the same language you did. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, bye. Thank you.